Looking for a graduation gift to inform, inspire, and encourage? When you give a subscription to Christianity Today, you're giving redemptive, relevant news and thoughtful, balanced dialogue about the church, current issues, and public theology. Visit orderct.com/graduate gifts to get a discounted student subscription for the graduates in your life. Starting at only $2 per month, this gift will engage and grow their faith throughout the year. Click the link in the show notes or visit orderct.com/graduate gifts to order now.
This episode is brought to you by Our Daily Bread Ministries, a global media organization that makes the life-changing wisdom of the Bible understandable and accessible to all. Visit whereyourfrom.org for more information. That's whereyafrom.org.
This is CT Media.
Folks, welcome to Being Human. I know for many of you, you have been following my work for several years, but for a lot of you, you're just discovering this work, this journey into noticing and naming and diffusing reactivity or anxiety so that our souls can be more open up, we can be more human-sized. You know, it frees us up to connect deeper to ourselves, to connect deeper to each other, and I think to have some profound connections with God. The first several episodes have just been me and my wife, Lisa, or with my coworker, Jimmy, as we lay some foundation for this series. But in a lot of ways, the heart of this podcast is interviewing guests. I love having people on and having them talk about their specialty, but also having them engage this simple idea of being human. And today's guest, I've been excited about having him on for a while. We're chatting to Dr. Esau McCauley. He is a phenomenal human being in so many ways. He's probably most known as a New Testament scholar. He did his doctorate in Galatians under N.T. Wright. He's a professor at Wheaton College, but he's written a couple of books and he's got a couple coming down the pike that I think are really vital and essential. His first book, Reading While Black, many of you are probably familiar with. And then he did a memoir of his life, just a beautifully written book, How Far to the Promised Land. Coming up in the fall, he's releasing in 2024, The New Testament in Color, and then also a children's book, Andy Johnson and the March for Justice. Esau joined me while he was on sabbatical in England with his family. He was kind enough to give some time. We got right into his memoir, his life, How Far to the Promised Land, but he also brought a lot of poignant thoughts on being bigger and smaller, and he very graciously endured the gauntlet that I put my guests through. And so before we begin with the interview with Esau, I'd just like us to take a moment to relax ourselves. And as I light the candle, just to remind us that God is with us, just invite you to take a couple of breaths and just take stock of where you are right now and ways that you might relax into God's presence. Just as I light this candle, I'm reflecting back on the conversation that Esau and I had. You know, he had a tough upbringing. He gets into it in the story. He gets really into it in his book. And yet he's this gentle soul. He's really done a lot of work inside. And so I began the interview by asking him where his empathy came from.
You ever been trapped by your own story?
Yeah.
And maybe feel like you're trapped by the way that people might use your story? I wrote How Far to the Promised Land at a certain point in my life. It was after the success of Reading While Black and after I had gotten the job with the New York Times and people were starting to notice who I was. And I knew that I had grown up in poverty and I experienced all of these traumas. And now I was in what people perceived as success. And because of that, I knew that people were going to want to throw away the rest of my narrative, and that the only part of the story that was important was that I began in one place and I ended in another. But I didn't want to feel like the people who I knew when I was a child and in my early years were people who you could just toss aside. These are people who I loved and who I cared about, even flawed people. And so I wanted to write a book that would make people love the people that I loved. And you could do that in such a way that you hide their flaws, but that felt like it was dishonest. And so I wanted to write a book that showed that broken people can be lovable and that they can teach us something about what it means to be human. In other words, it's not just the exceptional people who teach us, but even broken people. And this might seem to be too knee-deep into minutia at the very top of the podcast, but broken people can teach us positive things, not just things to avoid. And so there was just so much that I learned from people whom society would toss away. I tell this one story about these drug dealers who were nice to me, right? And so I received kindness from someone who did something that was objectively bad as a career. And how do you make sense of that? And so I was struggling with some of those themes in the book.
Yeah, in reading While Black, you actually dedicate the book to your dad. And at least to me, Esau, it presumed an affection.
Yeah.
And so then when we get into your memoir, I'm like, holy smokes, like your story is marked by absence. Like the way you've made meaning and grown through absence. Talk to me about how you're marked by absence over presence. That's fascinating.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm going to say something about that intro thing that you just mentioned. Sometimes we as writers, we can be 20% too cute because we got to have something that entertains us and that makes the writing process something enjoyable. Or sometimes as a writer, there are things going on in your subconscious that you don't really realize the full implications of until later. So people who don't know about books or writing books, you normally do the dedication at the end of the book, not the beginning of the book. So you write the book, you send it to the editors, they come back and they kind of say, well, who do you want to dedicate the book to? What do you want to say? Who do you want to dedicate it to? And so the book says, this book is dedicated to my father. Whatever else I am, I remain your son. And so everybody who opens the book and sees that thought of it as, oh, his dad must have been this really positive influence on his life. And I knew that if Reading While Black was successful, people would link me and my father. And they would have a certain understanding of our relationship. But that was actually my way of saying, and nobody else in the world knew about it but me, I forgive you. And so, in a sense, How Far to the Promised Land is like the prequel to Reading While Black. It's like, how do you get to the place where you can actually forgive the people who hurt you? And so, How Far to the Promised Land is a book that is, this is what you talked about. It was centered around the absence. Because one of the things that you want as a kid, what you want is like a mom and a dad who loves you.
Yeah.
And the absence of that paternal love shapes us. And so it's like if you're trying to make a puzzle and the whole point of the puzzle is discover the piece that is missing. And so what How Far to the Promised Land deals with are all of the ways in which my father's absence shaped me. For example, even before, back when I was in, elementary school and middle school, and I thought girls is gross. I want nothing to do with girls, right? I always wanted to be a father and a husband because I could feel, even as a kid, I could feel it, the ways in which my father's absence was wounding me. So I would see other people playing with their dad, and I wish I had a dad who played with me. And so as a kid, I had this, you have these questions and you get these questions in your head as a kid. I remember thinking so clearly, how would a child's life look differently if at every place my dad was absent, there was a father who was there? So even before I had any understanding what it meant to be a husband and a father, I want to be a father so I can watch a kid grow up to see if love might help that kid. And so there is a sense in which the people who abandon us shape us. And part of me dealing with my own narrative was coming to grips with the ways in which, for good and bad, his absence had a tremendous impact on me.
I really appreciate you sharing that. It's in my field, systems theory, one of the things we do is we look at generational traits. People actually sometimes will mark their, look at the generations of their family. And it's quite a common thing. I'm curious if this was something you struggle with, Esau. It's a common thing when you grew up with an absent dad or an abusive dad, that when you become a dad, like you've got four kids.
Yeah.
When you become a dad, you kind of anxiously swing the pendulum too far the other way. So my question is not very well worded, but are you hard on yourself when you make parenting mistakes, for example? Do you expect yourself to be like the parent your dad never was, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's one of the things I explored in the book. Because when I first thought about being a parent, I thought it would be easier than it is. Because I was like, oh, you just gotta love your kids. And then you begin to realize what it actually means to come alongside of another person's life. And I had to realize a couple of things. One is my children aren't me and I'm not my father. And so I can't relive my childhood through my children, but I can be a presence in their lives for the good. And as I began to kind of make the kind of mistakes that you do as a parent, wait, this is going to slide into parenting, but I'll say some things that I learned. One of the things that I learned is looking back on my childhood, I recognized that I didn't actually need a perfect dad. I just needed a good dad. In other words, the problem in my life was not that I didn't have a perfect father. It's that I didn't have a father at all. And so once I freed myself from the need to be perfect, then it gave me freedom to make mistakes. But it also, I started to use those mistakes to give my children permission not to be perfect. So if I would do something wrong, I'll call them all together and say, listen, your dad was wrong when he, you know, got frustrated with, you know, one of the children. I was wrong in front of everybody. I can apologize in front of everybody. But if I'm able to apologize for making mistakes and I'm your father, then you can apologize to your brothers and sisters for making mistakes. In other words, we're a family. It's learning how to love one another. And so rather than giving myself the standard of perfection, what I do hold myself to the standard of is modeling when I mess up to admit that mistake and make it right in front of them. And so hopefully that gives them like less pressure to be perfect. And I mean, I'm not the perfect father, but I think I've learned how to give my children freedom. One of the other things is like, my children aren't like I was at all. So like some of my kids are really, I was a big sports person.
Yeah.
Not all of my children are into sports. The other thing that is really different is, and I found that maybe this is helpful, like I had a son and then a daughter. And having a daughter helped free me. I don't have memories of being a daughter. If that makes any sense. I had a particular series of events associated with a father and a son. But when my daughter was born, there was like less baggage. I didn't have a script that I needed to replay out with the girl. And so that just kind of loosened everything up in our family to allow me to kind of, I don't know, just live rather than undo the past.
I think one of the great gifts of being an adult of trauma is you can introduce playfulness into your family. Yeah. You strike me as quite a playful person, which is saying something, Esau. You've got a freaking PhD in like Galatians. and Galatians, if I may, out of all of the New Testament books, not a very playful one.
Oh, no. Paul is in his feelings in Galatians.
Paul's he's a little testy.
He's a little testy.
Talk to me about your wife, Mandy, is I believe a captain in the Navy, right? So you guys are both, you have very serious work you do. Tell me about playfulness in your life and in your family and how it's helped.
Well, interestingly enough, and this is one of the hard things that you talk about, once again, trauma. One of the hard things for people to understand is the complex nature of damaged people. So my father was both abusive and hilarious. So when he wasn't on drugs, he was one of the funniest people anybody ever met. My family, like he was just the life of any room. He walked in and his personality filled the room. He was like a jokester. He joked around with everybody. And interestingly enough, that part of his personality I also have. And so although, I'll put it this way, when I was a kid growing up, I didn't have a lot of money. And in my neighborhood, like we joked on each other. He called it roasted. We roasted each other all of the time. And if you don't have money, you are a prime target. If your shoes aren't on point, if your hair isn't on point, if your clothes are messed up, then people are going to rag you. So the only way you can survive is you have to be able to give it as good as you got. In other words, I was always at the financial weakness when it came to having things on the surface you could joke with me about. But if I was quick on my feet, then that could allow me to function in a prettier space. Another thing that actually happens is in kind of dangerous context, which is where I grew up, humor can diffuse tension. And so we got really good at strategic uses of humor that helped us kind of survive. And so that sense of humor I brought into my family's life. I just always been the kind of person who was naturally kind of jovial. And one of the things also you have to model is, how do you tell jokes and not be at the expense of other people? And so in my family, I just think that laughter is a value that we share. And if you come to our dinner table, you're going to hear laughter every night.
That's an incredible generational gift you're giving your kids, for sure.
They call it trauma laughter. There is a sense in which if you don't come from where I come from, you don't understand the things that we find funny. In other words, there's a certain ridiculousness to racism or injustice or poverty that you either have to laugh at or it drives you crazy. I tell this one story in the book. I'll cut out 90% of it and get to the end. Maybe it'll just ruin this part of the book. I found myself being like, this guy was trying to arrest me, right? And he said, there's a warrant out for your arrest. And I said, oh man. So I'm like getting handcuffed or whatever. I'm like 17, 18 years old at the time. And for whatever reason, I don't even know why. I said, like, what year did I commit this crime? Like, when did this felony occur? Because I remember seeing on Law and Order that if you can establish an alibi, you can kind of get out, right? Okay, like, oh, it was a Friday night. I had a football game that night. And the guy goes, it was like December 12th, 1989. I was like, I was 10 years old in 1989. How could I be committing armed robbery? And the guy looks at me. And then he says, he kind of goes back and he gets to his car and does some little buttons again. And he goes, oh, you know, that's your father. Me and my father share the same name. Do you know where the whereabouts of your father? His last known address is, you know, this, this, and this. And I said, I don't know. But if you see him, tell him he owes me child support. Which is like a crazy joke to tell, right? I'm like hemmed up, about to be arrested for suspicion of armed robbery for some grocery store in 1989. And I'm like cracking jokes because the entire scenario, the idea that a 17-year-old kid would be confused with a 38-year-old man at the time was just ridiculous. And so what do? You laugh. And then I go back home and I tell that story over and over again with the same punchline. Man, I asked about child support. And you either laugh at it or you go crazy. And so I think that sense of joy in complicated circumstances has kind of come into our family.
Yeah. One of the powerful themes of the book is remembering. And it does feel to me like modern Western Christian faith is still hyper-individualistic. It feels in some ways like Jesus rose from the dead and then nothing happened. And then in the 1970s, we started singing folk music, right? We kind of don't have this like attachment to history, like, for example, the Catholics do. Of course, you're Anglican, so I may be stepping all up in your business with all that history. Yeah. But tell me about why remembering, I mean, it's such an ongoing piece of your book. Why is it so important?
It's because memory is the way that you take control of your story. So if you look at my narrative and say, hard work gets you to where you want to go, and that's the only lesson that you learn, that's actually not my story. That's the use of my story. If you were there where I was, you wouldn't think of my narrative in that way. And so as a survivor, I felt a strong responsibility to tell what actually happened rather than what people wanted to hear. And I talk about this a lot, how America, we love our Horatio Alger stories. Like, you started at the bottom and now you're here. And you just dip them in chocolate. You make a black Horatio Alger story and everything is great. But if I saw someone, right? If I'm sitting in the classroom And there are people just as talented as I am, or more talented than me, just as smart, just as hardworking. And there are circumstances beyond their control that got in the way of their thriving. Then it's a dishonest story for me to tell that it's simply you work hard enough and you'll make it. I just don't believe in manifesting. What do you mean manifest? If you talk about manifesting, the idea is the people who didn't get it didn't want it bad enough, or they didn't grind hard enough. I said, you just don't know any hardworking people. Because if you really believe that it's sufficient, it's hard work and planning, then that's just not true. And so part of what I wanted to do, I guess let me put it this way. The trickiest thing is the only people who usually get to tell their story are the successful people. And so people want to hear the story of how a successful person became successful. But those aren't the only stories to reveal what America is like. And so I just felt like I remember very vividly when I was in college and I would sit in auditoriums. Because before I became a writer, I was a speaker. But when I was in college, I'll be sitting in the auditorium and some speaker would come. And I remember I would think to myself, if this speaker's going to tell the truth, or tell us what we want to hear. Let's be as a Black speaker. And I said, I hope that that speaker tells it like it actually happened. And so when I stand up to speak or to write, I am not thinking simply about what I want. I am thinking about what the people in the audience who don't have the microphone or the pen deserve to have recounted. And so for me, writing is a tremendous responsibility. It's a tremendous honor. There aren't that many people who get the opportunity to write books that can be in bookstores all over the country. So I only got so many books in me in my life, right? So every single time I sit down to write something, I'm stewarding the story of a people. And so for me, I don't know how else to write other than to remember. And part of it becomes from being a Christian, right? When they sat down to, you know, finally make the decision about what became our Bibles. I know it wasn't done once. It was done over centuries and all that other stuff. What I'm saying is there were numerous points in the history of the church where we could have just tossed aside the Old Testament and said, you know what, let's just pick the story up when Jesus shows up. And said, no. There's something important about keeping the whole thing from Genesis to Revelation. And there's something that is missing. But we don't know the whole story. Even in the Old Testament, the rough bits, right? The fact that the people who should be heroic are oftentimes not heroic. And there's something beautiful that emerges from the memory. I'm going to talk about memory. Forgive me. I'm going to keep rambling on about this because this gets me going. In the book of Nehemiah, the people come back from exile, right? And they're rebuilding the temple. But in the process of rebuilding the walls, they sit down and they recount the history of the nation. And they talk about all of the stuff that they've done wrong. And they say, here we are, slaves to this day in the land our forefathers gave to us. So one of the first things that they did in the process of rebuilding their physical landscape was engaging in retelling their story. And they felt the responsibility to tell that story. And so I just don't think forgetfulness of our past is a very Christian way of thinking about things.
This episode is brought to you by the Truce Podcast. I'm sure you've been there. You're at an event, a dinner, a small group, and someone says something like,
"If you're a Christian, you have to vote Republican."
Huh. That raises an interesting question. How did evangelicals like me get to the place where we just assumed we'd all vote one way? This season on the Truce Podcast, we're diving deep into the complexity of the 1970s and 80s to understand how evangelicals tied themselves to the Republican Party. It's a story that involves murder, corruption, redemption, and our need to be heard. I'll be talking with celebrated historians like Rick Perlstein, Pulitzer Prize winners Francis Fitzgerald and Jesse Eisinger, and some of the best guests I've ever had. Truce is the show that uses journalistic tools to look inside the Christian church. We press pause on the culture wars in order to explore how we got here and how we can do better. Subscribe to Truce anywhere you get podcasts or listen at trucepodcast.com.
What I loved most of all about Israel and why I became a Zionist was because Zionism was a rejection of victimhood.
A few weeks ago on CT's The Bulletin, we launched Promised Land, a new podcast about Israel and Palestine in a post-October 7th world.
6:30 a.m. we're in our synagogue praying, and sirens go off, and they're going on.
Based on interviews and conversations captured on the ground in Israel last November, it's an exploration of the spiritual, political, and historical roots of the conflict.
When there's a weak Israel, every Jew in the world is weak.
And why should a Russian Jew who has nothing to do with this land come here? Why? Well, I mean, if you want, you can give them Texas. You love them so much.
I am alive because I didn't come home. But all my friends that were here were murdered. Here, over there.
This week, Promised Land moves to its own feed. You'll find links in the show notes. So if you haven't heard it yet, you can go catch up and catch the new episodes as they come all in one place.
I'd like to move our conversation into my field a little bit, Esau. One of the things I train people to do is notice when they've gotten bigger or smaller than human size. The simple idea being, when we're human size, we're connected to ourselves, we're connected to our people, we're aware of our connection with God. When we get bigger than human, we feel a need to kind of be aggressive. When we get smaller than human, we move into self-protection. Yeah. Sometimes this can be most keenly noticed when you're the only one of your kind in a room. Yeah. So in a perfectly playful way, my teenage daughter is a Swiftie, and sometimes she'll bring her friends home for lunch, and I'm a middle-aged white man surrounded by all these Swifties, and it's terrifying. But in a more serious way, if you are the only black man in a room, for example, the theory would suggest, I'd love to get your take on this, the theory would suggest that you are working extra hard to stay human-sized. Does that strike you as true?
Oh, I mean, I think that's very true. There's this scene recorded towards the end of the book in the chapter on Black holidays. And it talks about, my wife's a pediatrician. So I'm in this room with she's a pediatrician in the military. So at some point I'm in this room with doctors, lawyers, a bunch of fancy people. I'm the only black person in the room. And like they asked me a question about, you know, what do your family do for the holidays? And I recognized that I couldn't tell them the stories of what actually happened in my families during the holidays, because I was the only black person that they knew. And if I talked about poverty, drugs, then that's going to create a perception of who black people are, full stop. And so sometimes when you are a black person in a room, you cease to become an individual. You become black people personified.
You become the representative speaking on behalf of all black people.
Yeah. So you either can like grow to fill that role. You take on the role. Yes, I'm black people. This is what we think. Or you kind of shrink back from it. And for me, I often kind of pull back just because, and it sounds weird because I wrote a whole memoir, but sometimes it's like, I don't trust you with my story. Because in this one interaction, I can't give you the full nuance. And so part of how far to the promised land, not to bring it back to the book, was to like tell the whole story so that people can understand like individual bits of it. The other thing that is really hard, and I was talking about this, you talk about like growing or shrinking. When you walk on a stage as an African-American speaker and you have a largely white audience who comes from a totally different context from you, you're engaging in an internal struggle. Do I become the fullness of who I am, even if it's rejected, or do I become what people want me to be so that I might win their approval? And so I talk about at the beginning of How Far to the Promised Land, the decision I just made to be myself. But that decision to be yourself is a decision you have to make every single day. When I talk about this phenomenon, it's like the further you go in life, the more difficult it is to continue to be yourself and not to shrink or to grow. What I mean by that is when the people of Israel, and I know they weren't perfect, when they left Egypt, they had nothing to rely on but God. Manna, day by day, day by day. But there's some passages that speaks about when they got into Canaan. And they said, man, we're in Canaan now. We need to figure out what the gods of this land are like so we can worship them. So in other words, God in the wilderness is great, but God in this new land, we don't know if we trust Yahweh or whatever. And so for me, when I first wrote, I sat down to write Reading While Black, nobody knew who I was. I didn't have a column. The stakes were shockingly low.
Yeah.
And I was super frustrated when I wrote that book around the ways which people tried to, I felt like, limit me. And so I was writing my way towards freedom in that book. But then when it succeeded, I was like, well, oh, maybe I need to like shrink back down to like stay in this good land, right? That the Lord has given us. Maybe there's the new gods of the land you should worship. And so for me, it's been a consistent decision to stay my Christian Black free self in a changed circumstance where there is a lot of people who are giving me advice and telling me about who I should be and what I should become. And so the rebellion that I see now is not that I don't change. Everybody should change and grow. But I'm changing and growing in congruence with what God wants me to be rather than shaping myself to fit what the majority culture wants me to be.
Yeah, in my field, systems theory, what you're describing is called differentiation of self. It's how can I be exactly who I am while staying connected to you rather than being what you want me to be or defining myself against you? That's the challenge.
Yeah.
A friend of mine who's a pastor in Michigan named Marvin Williams, he's doing his doctorate on differentiation in Black space, and his thesis is called My Whole Black Self. The simple, like, how do I bring my whole Black self, because he is predominantly in white spaces. That's where most of his pastoring is done. Yeah, I was really struck. He saw at the beginning of the book, you brought Luke, your son. He sat down on the front row as you were on stage, kind of unintentionally or otherwise representing all Black people for all kind.
Yeah.
And it was really a powerful story where you very politely but firmly refused Chin. Just give us a little context on that. I found that to be so instructive.
Yeah, so my son, he's a teenager now. He's 15. He was like 7 or 8 years old at the time.
Yeah, they keep getting older.
Yeah, he grows. He's an amazing kid. Love him to death. But he was a young kid who was a big fan of Lecrae, the hip-hop artist Lecrae. And Lecrae was speaking at this conference. And so I went to go and speak at the conference. And I brought my son along because my son wanted to meet Lecrae. And so me and Lecrae were giving these lectures on whether or not Christianity was a friend or foe to racism in America or something like that. And so during the Q&A, a question came from the audience. Please tell us about the most racist thing you've ever experienced. And like me and Lecrae looked at each other, and before he could speak, and you could actually look this up on YouTube, it's in UNC. I went back and looked at it to see if I was exaggerating, but this is exactly how it happened. And so I said, no, I don't think we'll answer that question, we'll pass. And that was because what I spoke about earlier. Basically, if I tell you a story of racism, the plot is pretty clear. You know, because I'm standing in front of you, that I survived, that I made it through whatever it was. And so all you have to do is say, boo to that bad racist guy and go Esau. That is a pretty simple, it requires little of the reader other than the cathartic journey of seeing the trauma and then thinking that it was horrible. And so rather than giving people snippets of a story, I thought the only way to tell a truly holistic story of the Black experience in America is it needs to be told over time, and it needs to include the complexity of the human experience. In other words, there are competing factors that are going on in the lives of Black and brown people and in the lives of all human beings. In Black people in particular, or maybe I'll say in my story in particular, there are three overlapping themes you come across in the book. Extreme poverty, right, that impacted me. The second one was anti-Black racism, structural racism, the things that goes on in this country, but also family trauma. Or maybe I had a fourth one, my own brokenness, my own sinfulness. And so when you ask me what are the things in the way of my flourishing, if I simply said systematic racism, tell me this racist stuff that happens to you, that's overly simple. If I say, it's my own personal responsibility, that's the only thing getting in my way, that's overly simplistic. If I say, everything that happened to me can be explained by the lens of my familial trauma, well, that's true, it's part of it, but that's not the whole thing either. Or it's poverty. And the crazy thing about that is these things don't send you a checklist the day before. I didn't get an email from these four things. Okay, on Tuesday, October the 21st, poverty and racism are going to show up. It's like you wake up, you begin your day, and you don't know which one of those things are going to be defining for your experience. And to tell the true story of a human life involves including all of that so that you can see that the simplistic answer that we sometimes put forward to people are insufficient. So you can't simply give me a structural answer, and you can't simply give me a personal answer. The truth is somewhere in a combination of those.
The way I also took your story, I'd be curious if I read something into it that wasn't there. But the way I also took it, Esau, trauma costs.
Yeah.
It costs you and it costs to talk about.
Yeah.
There's also, like, when I've worked with people who have profoundly violent, traumatic things happen to them, even though it happened to them, they carry a shame. They would like to walk into a room where people don't know that happened to them. Isn't there also something to, like, when you're standing on a stage, tell me the most racist thing that happened to you, isn't there a part of you saying, no, I don't think I want to pay that price today?
There are times in your life where there's something that happens to you, and all that you can really say is, I survived it. And you don't really have a testimony other than, like, God allows me to be alive despite the fact that this thing happened to me. And sometimes you get to the place where a story no longer controls you. Like, the trauma doesn't always come back when you remember it, but you gain control of the story. And then you can bend that story to your purposes. In other words, instead of it locking you up and sending you into this fear response, you can say, no, I can deploy this story for a good cause. Not that the story was good, but I can use it to help other people. That's one way of talking about trauma or survival. The people who experience the trauma can talk about it to help other people deal with their trauma. And so I felt like I had come to the place in my life where the stories that I told were the stories that I had a hold of. In other words, the book is 180 pages. That isn't my whole life. And it's not even the most dramatic stuff that happened to me. It's the stories that I can make sense of morally and spiritually, and I can use those things for the glory of God. The parts of my story that are just, I survived it, I didn't tell you about. And so for me, like, I'm constantly working to move more of the trauma, the survival parts of the story, into the testimony parts of the story. And how about the promised land are the parts of myself that I guess I would say have been reintegrated into my narrative.
Okay. As we explore the ideas of being bigger and smaller than human, there is a third category that to me is always at the end of racism. And that is when one human is trying to dehumanize another human or strip them of their dignity. What do you notice there? Like, how can we hold each other's dignity in these situations?
I think that dehumanization is often rooted in a desire for power and control. And so I'm not saying that all racism is reducible to greed. There's an economic and social benefit to racism. Because racism is at its bottom the rooting of your value in something other than that which God values, right? So if you're saying I'm better than you by virtue of my race, then you've added something to your core humanity, which is the basis of our worth. And so if you dehumanize someone, then you have, even if there's no economic benefit, there's a social benefit. And so one of the things that I was trying to do was rehumanize people in How Far to the Promised Land. And what I mean by that is there are a lot of characters, including my father, who we just want to dismiss. Oh, he's just an addict and a criminal. And once you say that, it relieves you of the need for empathy. And so what I want to say is that one of the things that marks African-American Christianity is how the image of God functions in our theological universe. Like, the belief in the image of God is common to Christianity. but it often lies inert in certain Christian spaces, or it's functionally irrelevant. But it's a central teaching to the Black church. It's kind of like a major key on the organ. And what I mean by that is a person is a person is a person. And one of the key elements of the abolitionist movement was, no, we're people. You can't do what you're doing to us to a person. You can't chain a person. You can't whip a person. You can't physically assault a person. You can't split a family apart from one another, because that's a real husband and a real wife who has real love for their children. And so the consistent demand of Black Christians to say, see me, has been our way of resisting anti-Black racism. And so I think that what you refer to as empathy at the beginning of our conversation is me saying every single person that you encounter is a person. And one of the things I talked about dehumanization is it allows you to end their story. In other words, once they're not a human, then there's no redemption possible. But the whole point of Christianity, at least one of the points of Christianity, is that as long as we draw breath, our story isn't over. And that God is able to snatch a victory from anywhere in our narrative. And so we're patient with people because we really, really believe that God isn't done with them. And so when we dehumanize someone, we're effectively saying, I can look at you and tell that you're not a part of God's redemptive purposes, which puts you almost in the place of God, which I think is really dangerous.
As a Black Christian man, what's something you'd want me to know as a white Christian man that I might not know?
Well, I think that one thing that I would say, our stories aren't as separate as people might expect. What I mean by that is there are certain distinctive elements of Black Christian life, because there's distinctive elements of what it's like living as a Black man in America. And for that reason, our faith and practice takes its own shape. But at bottom, we're humans. And so what often happens is there's kind of two categories of books. Their books or sermons or whatever you want to call it are universal. You know, C.S. Lewis, Mere Christianity is universal. Tim Keller's The Reason for God is universal. N.T. Wright's Simply Christian is universal. But then when a Black person tells their story, it's particular, it's for Black people. And his job is to teach white people a lesson. But Black people are humans. And so some of the things in my narrative, because I'm a human living a human life, are going to be common to you because you are living a human life too. And one of the things that's been most surprising about the response to some of my work is that people go, I'm not from where you're from, but I completely get what you're talking about. That's like, because we're human. And so I think that one thing that is important to understand is that we're not a separate category of being. We're people living a life. And for that reason, distinctively Black stories can also be profoundly universal. It might be weird to say this, but in part, How Far to the Promised Land, maybe that like accounts for its poetic resonances or whatever, is that I had a clear idea in mind that I kind of wanted to write a Black Surprised by Joy or a Black Seven-Story Mountain by Thomas Merton. In other words, I wanted to speak about the universal longing for God and the search to find him in a distinctively Black context. And so the only journey to God that I can recount is the journey to God over and through and despite anti-Black racism. The only journey to God that I can recount is over and through and dealing with family trauma. The only story of God that I know about is dealing with poverty and racism. But at bottom, the story is me making sense of God. So if there's a subversive part of the book, underneath all of the what do you need to know about Black life in America is one kid trying to make sense of God in a world that seems very, very complicated and confusing.
Esau, I look at your life. You studied under N.T. Wright and you wrangled Paul and Galatians. However, you have not yet endured the being human gauntlet of anxiety.
Oh my goodness, that's true. Here we go.
Here are five questions. Feel free to pass or play on any of them.
Okay.
These are rapid fire answers. Question number one, how do you know when you're not well?
When my anxiety starts to peak. One of the dangers of being introspective is that you get stuck in your own head. You run around and you circle an idea over and over again, or you play out scenarios in your head, or the pressures of doing all of this stuff sometimes feels like it lands on you all at once.
Yeah, that's a great answer. Question number two, what kinds of personality traits in another person trigger you the most?
Condescension, bullying, and cruelty, and maybe even what I would call manipulative networking. Be my friend because we're humans, not because there's some kind of thing we're trying to get from one another. So I just don't like the feeling of being manipulated.
Okay, very good. I'm grateful that the answer wasn't podcast hosts. That always becomes awkward. Yeah. Question number three, when you don't have all the information and maybe you're in a conflict with someone or things are just tricky, what goes through your mind?
Am I being taken advantage of? There's a long history of African-American writing, music, art, everything being taken from us. And we sign bad contracts or we get in relationships and people betray us. And I had a father who left me, right? So you can imagine it's hard for me to trust you. And if I don't have information, I was like, oh, you up to something. And so the fear of being abandoned or mistreated or something is probably what I would say.
Okay. Question number four out of five.
I made it three. Do I get a t-shirt or something if I do all five?
Oh, I'm totally mailing you a gift after this. There's no question.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Yeah, you're getting merch for sure.
Okay, merch. There we go. Yep. Okay.
Question number four. I think most followers of Jesus, including faith leaders, we experience a gap between what we believe and what we experience. Like, I believe God loves me, but I have struggled to experience God's love. Do you have a gap in your faith between what you believe about God and what you experience from God?
I struggle with like grace. You know, I believe that God saves me no matter what I do, but I feel like he did so much for me. I want to pay him back by being like a good person. And I have a very, very high doctrine of the church. And I don't experience that quite often. I was like, God, where's this wonderful family that you told me about that's supposed to love me no matter who I am, you know, united across race, socioeconomic class, male and being supposed to be this family. Where is it? And so that part is sometimes complicated as well.
Okay, final question. My favorite question. When in your life lately have you been in a situation where you just feel most fully and completely loved?
This sabbatical, traveling around England with my children and my wife. It's been great. We've been going to Evensong to listen to those ancient college choirs and in these beautiful buildings and the music's filling the room and our children aren't actually bored to death. They kind of embraced it. That's been probably the best part for me recently.
That's beautiful. My guest today is Dr. Esau Macaulay. He's an absolute force of nature, New Testament scholar. His books, Reading While Black, How Far to the Promised Land. You can chase him down with his New York Times columns. We'll have links to all of these in the show notes. And a children's book, Andy Johnson and the March for Justice. Esau, thank you so much genuinely for taking time out of your sabbatical to chat with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Being Human is a production of Christianity Today. It's executive produced by Eric Petrick and Mike Cosper. It's produced and edited by Matt Stevens. The associate producers are Mackenzie Hill and Ray Gilliam, with music by Dan Phelps, mix engineer Kevin Morris, and graphic design by Amy Jones.
Every day, CT testifies to the reality that Jesus is alive, transforming his world and bringing his kingdom to bear. Jesus transforms, CT equips. Make a gift to our nonprofit ministry with a gift of $20 to provide 150 more people with redemptive storytelling, global perspective, and thoughtful podcasts. Give now at morect.com/equip.